For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Wow, what a nice crowd, right? It's really interesting to sit with so many people, you know? I'm sure that you all experienced it in different ways. But I know I felt it was quite palpable, the power of this many people gathered in this little of a space, I guess. So I'm tackling a topic that's way too big. I'm jumping into the deep end of the pool. But every topic in Zen is like that. Coming into this room and sitting together like this is already too much for us to grapple with or understand. This is the wonder and power of Zen, this thing that we call Zen. So my topic tonight is Zen and the creative imagination. So being somewhat involved in academia, I'm a college professor, but I teach art. So I don't have to deal with heavy-duty kind of academic issues. Our teacher, Tygon, is, I guess he could be considered an academic. He might not like that word very much.
Former.
We have very ambivalent feelings about this academic stuff in Zen. And as an artist, I consider myself an artist, primarily. And so that's very much how I approach. As any of you who know me, you know that's how I approach many aspects of our practice and how I think about it, because it's my life. So Zen and the creative imagination, I was thinking earlier, speaking of this academic stuff, that this is the stuff of 1,000 PhDs. So I'm just going to dip a toe into these waters tonight. So the first thing is we have Zen and we have creative imagination. So already we're setting these things up as ideas, and even as ideas that should be complementing each other, or maybe even antagonistic in some way. And that is very much, I think, at the heart of our Zen tradition. We can look into the history of Zen and you can see these tensions, these dialectics that arise over time. And I think that we witness it in our own time, which is the most important thing. What are we seeing in our lives and in our time? And sort of on this note, Tygon recommended I read a book a few months ago called Visions of Power. It's by a French academic named Bernard Faure. And the subtitle is Imagining Medieval Japanese Buddhism. But the real focus of this book is a monk in, I guess, the 14th century Japan, named Keizan Jokin. And he was the fourth in line after Dogen. So there was Dogen, 2, 3, 4. Keizan. So, and he's, for many hundreds of years, in fact, he was a much more maybe influential figure in the actual shaping of Zen in Japan than Dogen was. Dogen became a somewhat sort of hazy, mystical, sort of misty figure. His writings that Tygon has translated many versions of, and Dogen, who's become these texts that are now circulating in our language, in our time and place, that are so influential, were basically not read by Zen monks in Japan for hundreds of years in many cases. So, but this man Keizan, who I happen to share the name, but the characters are different. It's a different K. his Kazon meant Firefly Mountain, and my Kazon means Respect Mountain. But and sort of maybe, not consciously, but maybe anticipating some kind of resonance, Taigen gave me this name. It's a long story about how he got there, but it wasn't like he's naming me after this guy. But I've found this really peculiar resonance with him. And one of the aspects that is so powerful about Kazon Jokin is the power of his imagination and his employment of creative imagination in his own practice, first and foremost, and then by extension, creating that power, the imaginative power was so strong that it basically created this, well, it turned Soto Zen in Japan into the largest Buddhist sect in that country, at least up till recently, if not still today. I think in numbers of temples, it probably still is. In numbers of practitioners, maybe not. I don't know. Any word on that, Taigen?
Jodo Shinshu is probably a little bit ahead, but yeah.
So it's up
more or less, yeah.
But speaking of Jodo Shinshu, there were a number of figures in the same medieval period. Beginning with Dogen, there was a monk also named Myōe, who is somewhat famous now in our time, among certain circles anyway, for being the first person to really, as a lifetime practice, record and interpret his own dreams. And these dreams were very important in his own practice. And then there were other sort of visionary luminaries, Buddhist luminaries, like Shinran, the founder of Shin and all of its many sects, his teacher Honen. In a way, you could say that their imaginative powers were very great, and that they envisioned, I think in a Judeo-Christian context, we would call them prophets. They envisioned ways of practice that were so powerful that they carry today. And so we're experiencing that power. And so I want to talk about what is this creative imagination from a couple of different viewpoints. So historically, as I talked about, there's this tension in Zen that I think that we see played out in our time. And the way we maybe see it played out in our time is you have those who argue that Zen is a sort of purely almost scientific discipline, that we don't need any of these trappings, right? We just need to sit and scientifically, physiologically, something psychologically, something will happen, and we will be bettered, we will be cultivated, we will be enlightened, perhaps, and that's the most important thing. And all of that's true, except when it's not. I have wrestled with these issues myself through my own practice now over a couple of decades, and wondered about these things, and encountered many different flavors of practice, many different imaginings of what Buddhism looks like. And so there's this other side of practice that has accoutrement, you know, robes and art and shaved heads and statues, you know. This is an imaginal realm. So what's the difference? That's a koan. I don't want to answer it, actually. I want to stop talking now, and we could just sit with that. But it's my job tonight to talk. So Figuring out what it is, I know, is very much part of my own practice. Because we have visions, we have dreams, we have ideas, we have thoughts, we have aspirations, we have feelings. These things arise, and they have to be incorporated into our practice. And how do we go about doing that? Well, one of, I think, the gifts, it's why I think myself, it's partly why I chose to listen, to heed the call to become ordained in this manner. And maybe why many of you are just simply here tonight. There's some kind of appreciation of these gifts that have been handed down to us. We could, on the one hand, we could call them techniques, and that's true. We could call them aesthetics, and that's true. We could, we could come up with various words. What is it that has been handed down to us? But we just see it, and we just did it. We're doing it together. And the more I find that I immerse myself into the practice, the more appreciation I have of the power of the imaginations of these individuals in the past, who, through careful listening to their own selves, their own practice, their own needs, their own myriad selves, this thing happens, and elements are brought in, and they provide us with opportunities to stretch our own imaginative capabilities. So Tigan likes to talk about maybe allowing a thought to think you sometimes. We're so self-centered. We think that our thoughts are our own, and somehow we think them, and somehow we can stop thinking them if we don't like them. And somehow we know which thoughts are the ones we should be thinking or not thinking. But this idea that maybe through exposure to this kind of venerable and trustworthy, I think highly trustworthy, imaginal realm. I think it's actually more trustworthy as in a kind of imaginal realm. Fauré uses this French word imaginaire, so I want to get back to that in a second. But this imaginaire that we're sort of immersing ourselves in, I think that's more trustworthy than maybe any specific points. Like, that's the thing with this religion. It doesn't have a dogma that we're supposed to believe. It almost has an atmosphere that we immerse ourselves in and just breathe, right? We just breathe it in and out. And we allow ourselves to perhaps be thought of as bodhisattvas. We don't even necessarily have to think of ourselves or others as bodhisattvas, but maybe in a way we're being thought of that way. That thought occurs to us, and we immerse ourselves in it. And then we discover in that, you know, we say these vows later, after the end of this, we'll say the four bodhisattva vows. And we say them, and they're very hard to believe. And I don't know if we're supposed to believe them so much all the time. Sometimes we do. But also just to keep immersing ourselves. Just like in Zazen, we don't believe it a lot of the time. And yet, we just do it. And we're immersed in it. We're enfolded in it. So, this Buddhist imaginaire, Faure, I'll just kind of... I found a couple little quotes that where he touches on this a little bit. So, Chan or Zen theory in its orthodox immediacy, so we kind of know that Zen is kind of about getting hit with the stick, right? Or you hear the sound of the pebble, or you see the tree in the garden and boom, you just see it. There's no mediation, right? There's no mediation. You just suddenly are one with everything, like the hot dog, like the Dalai Lama hot dog, right? Make me one with everything. So that's kind of the line, and that's what they sell a lot of the time. That's what a lot of these Zen guys have been selling, and we read this in the stories a lot. And the funny thing is, in certain traditions of Zen, you meditate on these stories and you imagine them so vividly, so you immerse yourself in that imaginary realm so much, you become the characters in the story. You are that person. There's no separate, there's no mediation there. So that in itself already sort of melts away some of these distinctions that we make. What's real? What's real in that moment? Is the story separate from you? Actually, the point is to erase the difference between you and the story in some of these techniques of meditation. So, in its orthodox immediacy, it presents itself as completely rejecting all mediation, rejecting the imaginaire as an intermediary or imaginal realm, dismissive of cosmologies, symbols, images. In other words, traditional beliefs and belief in general. He goes on to say, it goes without saying that practice looks somewhat different. And that's true, just as I kind of already said. So I think it's just really important that we just continue to examine, but not intellectually, with our practice body. We just keep examining what these things are and look for the places where we're kind of rigid and we're making these separate boxes. And just maybe allow them, just like the saying goes, to open our hand of thought. Relax around that. Allow vision to maybe emerge as a part of your practice. So it's a little bit tricky, and that's why you need a good teacher to help you navigate when you're just fantasizing in some way that's maybe not as productive. Maybe fantasizing in some ways is productive. But this imaginative capability that we have as human beings, well, it's very interesting that the Buddhist tradition itself has evolved to fully employ and even activate these capabilities. And in some traditions, it has blossomed in a much more explicit way. So has anyone in here practiced in the Tibetan tradition at all? So a little bit, me too. But Zen is my home and I'm happy here and I don't need to shop. But the Tibetans, very famously, they have a lot of visualization exercises, and maybe you've seen their art, which is the art are only tools to help in the visualization, so that you can, when you get really good at it, you can imagine like every pore on the Buddha and his entire retinue, dozens or hundreds of bodhisattvas and other Buddhas, and they're all different colors and they have all different hand positions and in different realms and different worlds and palaces that you traverse and to visit them. And you can, they work on these techniques to imagine all of this stuff, with the end result really being that you become what you imagine. And Zen, we don't do this so much. It's not so much our practice. But nonetheless, we still have these capabilities. And I sort of like, in particular, our Soto way of practice, maybe in particular the way Taigen presents it, but it's very open field. it's a very open field to maybe see how to employ some of these capabilities in your practice. Interestingly, you know, as these things go, this book, I just saw this yesterday, and it caught my eye. It just arrived last week, I guess and it's going to be in our library. But I picked it up. It doesn't look like something I'd normally pick up, but I just picked it up and I cracked it open to the page, Imagination and the Influence of the Buddha. That's how these things work. And very interestingly, it talks about how in the very roots of, even in the Buddha, the Shakyamuni Buddha's own time, that he recommended visualization exercises, using the imagination to assist you in your practice. So, Um, 40 methods of meditation known as kamathanas, or workplaces. So concentrating upon different elements, contemplating the ephemerality of the body. So imagining how your body is going to be a corpse. Et cetera, et cetera. Different feelings that you can cultivate. That's a kind of visualization, right? It's not necessarily just a picture in the mind. The imagination also includes simply thinking of someone that maybe you're not getting along with very well as decent. That is imagination. Sometimes it's a real leap of imagination, right? But that's our imagination too. Analysis of the four elements. But even, this was mentioning too, even in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, one of the last, his last teachings, just before he died, the historical Buddha recommended that his students build stupas in his memory so that they could continue to keep alive his memory, the idea of him, the imagination of him. And we can think that happened far away in a long time ago in a dusty place, lost in the sands of time, but here it is. That the power of that idea was so strong that we're still embodying it. So I'm doing pretty good. I haven't referred to my notes at all yet. But I wanted to talk about William Blake just for a second. Has anybody read? Raise your hand if you've read William Blake. So William Blake, you know, the famous kind of proto-romantic poet. One of my heroes, a fascinating figure. And he lived at a time when the scientific and rationalist worldview was just coming into its zenith. A zenith that we're actually kind of on the downward slope from, having seen all of its strengths and now increasingly many of its problems, right? So he warned us, like a true good prophet. He was like, watch out, you people. You are playing with fire. You don't know what you're doing. And his central message was that the power of the creative imagination will save us. Literally, from a Christian worldview, he believed that it was our saving grace. And and he said at one point, I know of no other religion than the liberty both of body and mind to exercise the divine arts of imagination. The world of imagination is the world of eternity. It is the divine bosom into which we shall go after the death of the vegetal body. All things are comprehended in the divine body of the Savior, the true vine of eternity, the human imagination. So he says over and over in many ways and places that the Holy Spirit, the Savior, the divine body of the Savior is the human imagination. Who appeared to me coming to judgment and throwing off the temporal that the eternal might be established. So that language is difficult for us, maybe. But I think we can even pull that into our Buddhist imagination, because that's where we're coming from. To just sort of shift those ideas so that they're more palatable to us, because I believe that where he's coming from is not different than where the Buddha was coming from, truly in its heart, and where these Zen heroes like Keizan, where they're coming from. And to grant ourselves, because no one else is going to do it, we have to grant ourselves the courage and the grace to embrace our wildest imaginings about what we're capable of, what our society is capable of becoming. Because it's pretty, I don't know, I think we could say it's actually pretty barbaric. The line that we're being sold most of the time is that we're the most evolved civilization ever. The most advanced. But I'm very skeptical. I think it's a very dubious notion. But we can imagine something better. We have to. And it begins with that. What is the quote from Thoreau? You've dreamed the dream, now build the foundations? Something like that. You've dreamed the house, now you must build the foundation. Something. I can't remember. But that's kind of how it works. And this isn't just a plaything. Our culture is so... Well, there was a quote in here that I also found. I thought said it so well. To some in the West, traditional images such as green Tara, he's talking about a particular visualization of a deity, can be obscure and difficult to relate to, especially as the relationship with our own native mythologies and local gods has been suppressed by the sustained antipathies of religion, rationalism, and materialism. That is so well said. Because these things...
Can you read that again, please?
Yeah. To some in the West, traditional images, visualizations can be obscure and difficult to relate to, especially as the relationship with our own native mythologies and local gods has been suppressed by the sustained antipathies of religion, rationalism, and materialism. We all need to find our own way into Buddhist imagery, and perhaps one obvious way to do this is by imagining the discoverer of Dharma, Shakyamuni. That's who's on our altar. The primary, the largest figure on the altar is a depiction of Shakyamuni. So we all, you know, could close our eyes and just imagine a picture of Shakyamuni. These imaginings can get clearer when we read stories, when we read the teachings, and we can, you know, as they begin, they're good stories. You know, thus have I heard. One day on Vulture Peak, the Buddha sat down before a retinue of 3,000 monks, and he spake thus. You know, these things help us. How do we approach them if not through the imagination? And so we have to, as the book said, we have to make friends with our native gods. This is something that Keizan, this book, very much touches on, but he was very involved in employing native mythologies and even imported mythologies and finding ways that they merge and they marry and they inform each other and they enliven practice so that we're not just here trying to get rid of thoughts we don't like, right? We're actually involved But to say that we're doing too much, I really want to understate that. We don't need to do much. In fact, we mainly need to do a lot less. But to just come and participate, to just bow in these ways that we bow, and to just sit quietly together and to listen to talks and participate in this, is already to engage this imagination and allow yourself a much broader field to move in. So I think I'll just leave it at that. Is that enough? Is that good?
That's good.
Well, now maybe some comments and some questions, and that's always the best part anyway. So thank you very much. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't mean this in a challenging way, but it seems like a fairly basic question, and maybe it gets to this thing we're talking about, the sort of Zen as science point of view versus what you're presenting. I mean, one of the things we hear all the time in Zen is, justice, So I'm just sort of wondering how, not how you square those tendencies sort of intellectually, but if you could just sort of maybe talk about how you imagine the way they square actually in practice. Is that a coherent question?
I don't think they square at all. maybe it's wanting them to square that ends up being one of the edges that gets rubbed off, right? I mean, that's why the symbol of Zen is a circle, the Enso. You guys have all seen that, right? The brush stroke. So then they have the other ones where there's a circle, a square, and a triangle, which I like those too. So sometimes it's square, sometimes it's a circle. Sometimes it needs to be squared. If you're going to build I come from an art background. There's a famous piece, a great piece by Bruce Nauman, one of the great kind of founders of conceptual art, a pretty Zen character, kind of a Zen cowboy character in New Mexico. And it's called, what is it called? I want to say squaring a corner. So I think it's setting a corner. And it's just a video of him digging a post hole for a corner, for a fence on his ranch in New Mexico. And sometimes you need to set a very clear point. And you sometimes it needs to be not this, not that. That's the stance. But sometimes it needs to be this and that. And the other thing. But you have to know for yourself, hopefully with the help of guides and friends in the world, which would just be giving you feedback, and yourself, are you doing violence to yourself? I think we need to be very careful, because Zen, because of our programming and some of our barbaric ways, I don't know, we abuse ourselves most of all. So many of us at different stages, we abuse ourselves with the practice rather than utilizing the practice to help us to honor these different parts. Yes.
Just to add in response to Nyesa, so just this is what's always before us. We sit, we face the wall, we face our life, but it's not just one thing. I mean, sometimes we can do practices to focus on our breath or some phrase or just this present posture. But I think what Kazan is talking about, using words like imaginaire or the imaginal or whatever, is the wholeness of our life. So Suki Roshi says to give the cow a wide pasture. Mm-hmm. To allow spaciousness means to allow three things to be present in our mind at once, is just this. Just this can include many things. It's not that we have to try and find things somewhere else. We don't do that, but many things arise. How do we stay present and upright in the middle of all of that? I think that's kind of how I understand just this. And sometimes it's narrow and sometimes it's very wide, and that's fine.
And the last thing I wanted to just say on that, because you were saying about science, that science is this one thing. I think if we actually look carefully at science, we start to realize where science at its best is much more like art.
But I was referring to science as you presented it, right. The sort of scientific
Exactly, yeah.
You have this sort of scientistic approach to Zen.
Right, scientific, yeah, that's a good distinction, yeah. Good points, yeah. Anybody else? Yeah, Douglas.
Yeah, I think there is an interesting tension in a way between the formless practice of not getting caught in any particular thought or emotion and being open to this, to the world, and in that awareness, each action in a way is an expression of just this and reality. But it's a little different from the side of imagery and Buddhist art. Even our practice is a form, really, it's a performance art. I mean, just like in Tibetan Buddhism, when we sit in the Zendo, where it's exactly like esoteric Buddhism, we're inherently enlightened, and we sort of evoke that and express it by sitting exactly the way the Buddha does. It's not just, in traditional Buddhism, just like in magic, you take the form of something powerful and you absorb that power. But it's not necessarily that so much as expressing your Buddhahood just because you're sitting like a Buddha. When we chant the chants, we're not chanting the chants to listen to the chants and figure them out. We are reciting the words of the Buddha or the enlightened ancestors as our own. And it's not, you know, there's a part of it is in these forms that aren't teaching us some sort of conceptual framework, really, but throwing us into a different world that is a Buddha world or a Zen world of the imagination, because we don't live in formlessness all the time, but we're constantly expressing that in a way and letting it go and then expressing it another way. The ritual and the art and the poetry, all of those things capture it at least partially for us.
My friend, I have a good friend who's an artist. This is just coming to mind. I want to touch on this distinction too, that just, or to reinforce my feeling that imagination, when I'm using that word, when Blake is using that word, when Faure is using the word imaginaire, he's not talking about pictures in the mind. And this is really important, like that we refine our idea of what creative imagination, with as Blake capitalizes it, he always capitalizes it, creative imagination. But this is a Buddha power. It's a wonder working power, as my people would have said. I come from many southern and that it's not pictures. In fact, I am really invested right now in a highly non-objective kind of art making where I just can't have any images. But my friend Peter Fagundo, great artist, he's always encouraging our students. We teach together, and he's always encouraging our students because he loves story, and he's painting very narrative, very representational pictures. What's before the story, though? There's something where the story's coming from. The image is coming out of. So to be aware of the source, even as you are visualizing the image, like, this is very Zen, I think, work for us. Like, if you can be aware of the source and the image. Nia and I have talked about this a little bit, too, where, like, in the Hindu tradition, you have deities, you know, all these deities, but they understand the deities coming from the one. But sometimes that spiritual force is felt as energy in the body, for instance, kundalini rising up the spine, right? Mm-hmm. But sometimes that energy appears as visions. And sometimes that energy, you know, I haven't had this happen, but it happens all the time, apparently, in traditions, you know, I'll see an angel walk through the door. Or I'll see Shiva burst through the wall, you know? This is possible. That's a way that spirit could manifest itself, and we could call that